Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy, and as always, here with Richard Hill. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Matt. How are you today? It's a fantastic day, I suppose. That sounds terribly enthusiastic, but it's great to be seeing you again. How are you going?
Yeah, going well, going well. So, Richard, today we thought that we've had a conversation with someone in Germany, an Englishman in Germany, who contacted us about a project that he's got concerning education, and we had a bit of a chat about that. And we thought it might be a good idea to let our listeners eavesdrop in the conversation.
Yes, really fascinating guy. And he'll talk to us a little bit about his early education, then his later dissatisfaction with education, and then the efforts and what he has created anew in changing, well, fixing the system up a bit. This is so much in the things that I've been talking about for such a long time. So who are we speaking to, Matt?
Yes, we're going across to Germany to talk to Jeff Walters. And he has created this marvelous platform, which we'll find out all about, called Universal OWL.
Yep, he's a fascinating guy. And let's ask him about how he got to where he is.
Okay, so before we jump across to Germany, thank you everybody for tuning in to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. And if you like what we're doing here, please consider becoming a subscriber to the scienceofpsychotherapy.net. So over there, you will find a wealth of information. We've got a marvelous store and archive of magazine articles and courses for the psychotherapist. And we would love you to join us and become part of the tribe.
All right, so off to Germany and to Jeff.
Growing up at school, I was pretty much a classical nerd. I didn't really have many friends. I just studied and studied and studied and studied. I am the son of two teachers, actually languages teachers. So again, there's that connection that we have in terms of languages. And I did this for a very long time. I got very good grades. I went to Cambridge University, and I very much over-identified with the academic system. It really was my life. It sounds like hyperbole, but it's really not. Like, I did almost nothing else. I think in the entire time I was at school, I maybe went out to like meet up with friends like a normal person maybe three times. It really is no understatement to say it was my life. And went to Cambridge, did pretty well at Cambridge. I got a scholarship my first year. And I figured in my youthful naivety at the time that I was doing everything right. And then I was 22 when I graduated, and life gave me a huge slap in the face because, as both of you gentlemen will be intimately familiar with, you know, life in the outside world doesn't work the same as the education system, which actually sets you up for failure in all sorts of ways. I went through some very tumultuous personal times, learning a lot about relationships, about money. My first few forays into the world of employment were a huge fail. I hated working for other people. I was really surprised because I'd been really academically skilled, and I figured I would just go and what the working world would just be a breeze, but it really wasn't at all. I really, really struggled for a year. I was depressed. I was burned out multiple times. My solution to this was basically kind of the classic Jeff solution to more or less anything, which is I'll work harder. So I kind of doubled down on work. I decided I would start my own business, which honestly, if I had known how hard it was going to be, there's no way in retrospect I would have done so, because as you guys will both know, self-employment can be a beast quite a lot of the time. And much to my shock, again, with my ego at the time being sky high, thinking I can do anything, I failed not only once, but I failed multiple times. So multiple failed businesses, one after the other, starting in 2013. I think there were four or five of them that just did not get off the ground at all. Got to the point where I was really, really struggling and didn't know what to do next. Had failed a bunch of times, and my self-esteem was in the gutter, as you can imagine. And so a friend says to me, why don't you become a writer? Because you studied languages at university, you've always been good at communicating, you're an articulate chap. So I say, well, I'm broke, I'm desperate, I need money, I may as well try, I've got nothing to lose. What followed ended up going from a one-man writing shop into a content marketing agency, which actually did very well. And I was actually really shocked at the time because I'd failed so much and I wasn't expecting myself then to succeed. So I hired a bunch of people, ended up selling the company at the end of 2019. And then I was like, well, what do I want to do now? Because I feel like I've achieved a measure of professional success. And I was thinking back to some of my old earlier, more idealistic businesses. And I was thinking, well, why don't I try and solve a really, really hard problem? And I think one of the biggest problems in the world currently is the problem of education. And I've experienced that myself. People might say, well, I have so much privilege because I went to very fancy learning institutions and such. But I would say that it's almost more of a problem to over-identify with the system than to be under-identified in the system, because then you really can't tell apples from oranges, because you're so engrossed in this alternate sense of reality that you just have no idea how life works. So Universal Hours really set up to answer the question, what skills does each individual need to succeed in reality and to thrive, and to be a good and moral person? And then how do you teach those skills at scale? And as I said, it comes from my personal journey.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. I mean, it's I think when and because we have a lot of therapists listening to the program, so sometimes our best case study is the case study we're most familiar with, which is our own. Just listening to that and sort of pretending that you were telling me a case study was really revealing. And there were so many things, and I was actually sitting like a good therapist and jotting down notes at all. Yes, right. Yeah. But that beautiful thing of going through a system that's supposed to teach you how to solve problems, coming out of that system into the place of problems and finding that you can't solve problems, falling down miserably and just solving any problem that came up because what have I got to lose? And the enormous power of unregulated activity or undemanding activity, which then led you to a situation where you came back to where you were in the first place, which was, how do I solve a problem? Mm. And you were forced to be in an entirely different space and going, okay, everything I've learned, let's forget that. What's the real way of solving a problem? And then I hear you saying this thing of education that's doing that, what we call a closed system. You know, it's a closed system. Yeah. And so the problem to solve, if I'm picking it up, was how do I turn learning into something that is an open system so that expands and extracts. So what did you do? How did you do that?
It's funny you expressing it like that, because I feel very much like I'm in therapy right now in this conversation, so no pressure. Been to therapy multiple times. This kind of feels a bit familiar, talking to two experienced counselors and such. I was actually doing a bit of research into your book, Richard, for this conversation, and I was skim reading aspects of it, and I noticed that you talk a lot about the idea of the creative world and this idea that you can, instead of being, correct me if I'm wrong, but your ideas seem to be a lot about avoiding achievement orientation. That's kind of how I looked at it anyway, with my kind of past and obsession with achievement orientation. Yeah.
Well, just today, with external achievement, externally right. valued, externally evaluated achievement, self-achievement, but that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah.
So this is like, what's it called? It's called extrinsic validation as opposed to intrinsic validation. That's another way to put the same point. Yeah. So I guess to come to sort of the truths of what you've been talking about, I think my journey has been like a lot of experimentation and play. I, like the first couple of years of entrepreneurship, I was failing and it was brutal. I mean, I would hate to go through that experience again. It was unbelievably painful because there were so many things I learned in my past that I had to unlearn. I think that's actually also very, very challenging. But I was really just going from idea to idea and exploring. And I find that play is unbelievably valuable. I tell this to people I work with and people I'm close to all the time. I think everyone needs to be able to play on a regular basis just to kind of explore ideas. My business partner for Universal, Alan, myself, are actually currently exploring the idea of turning the whole of these kind of philosophies, which I could expand upon at length, into a board game. Yeah. And then kind of you teach that to kids so they would have like a board game to show them how to become self-sufficient, like human beings who pursue a meaningful and moral life. I feel like also a big part of my philosophy is essentialism. I don't know whether you guys have read much about that.
Yes. Remind me again, who's the English author who wrote the book on essentialism?
I can't actually remember, which is quite awkward.
It's not essential. Yeah.
It's not essential. No. But nice. I do remember reading the book and Marvelous Philosophy.
I was reflecting about this just a couple of weeks ago, and I was thinking that actually that's a big part of what Universal Hour is about. It's as much about focusing on what matters, and I think school purports to teach people the skills that they need in order to lead a good life, but like empirically, that's just not the case. And I sometimes use the example of if someone were to go through a corporate training program for say 12 or 13 years. And, you know, it was to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they were to invest all of this time and money. And then they were to come out and they thought that all they were good for was a job at Starbucks. People would rightly say, well, this was a huge waste of time and money. And how many things did you learn that actually were completely pointless? There's not necessarily to take a knock at Starbucks. You're perfectly fine to work as a waiter if you choose to. The thing is, though, is that if you're spending all of this time, like the opportunity cost of just a loan associated with that is just absolutely insane. Essentialism is really about eliminating all of the unnecessary. And actually, I was also reading a bit about Tim Ferriss yesterday, and I made the connection that his deal philosophy, which I think stands for like define, the second one is definitely eliminate. It's the idea of elimination is core to essentialism.
Right. I just went through my audio books, Essentialism by Greg McKeown. Is that how you say it? Yeah. But don't ask me to break it down because I can't remember, but I do remember it. It was an awesome book. Jeff, I've got your, so for listeners that didn't catch it, your project is called Universal Owl. And I've got it open here on the mission page. And it'd be really cool if you could just step us through some of the elements there you've got as mission for you guys.
Yeah. So, I mean, Universal Owl, as I said, it's born out of my personal experiences. And the idea is to teach each young person in the world eventually the universal skills that you need to be happy and successful and moral and self-sufficient and all the rest of it. That stands in contrast to the present education system. And I was making some notes here on my notepad before our call, and I was trying to think of some terms to kind of sum up what the education system teaches us psychologically. And what I wrote down, we've already talked about one of them, which is achievement orientation, and achievement in this extrinsic sense that we already just talked about. I think another thing that education teaches us classically is compliance, and I have a lot of problems with that ethically. I think there's this sense of disconnection from reality, which we've talked about a little bit, which I could talk about more. There's also a lack of focus, which again is linked to essentialism. And maybe the most important one actually for me personally, just because of all of my research about relationships and healthy communication and the fact that the first course we're producing is about assertiveness, the inability to say no. So I was talking to a friend about this just a few days ago, actually, and I was using another example from my own life. So I really disliked geography in school. I was good at pretty much everything. I was even good at geography, but I just found geography unbelievably tedious. And I knew this from the age of about 13. And in retrospect, it would have been marvelous if at 13 I could have said, actually, I don't find geography very interesting or valuable. I'd like to give it up. I'd like to, in other words, say no to the geography teacher. Mm. But of course, if you do that, at least you're speaking from a British perspective. If you do that in school, they'll say, well, exactly, you're a bad student. You get all of this kind of shaming language. Even at Cambridge, actually, there was a time when I was doing a French module in my final year. And I decided that some lectures just weren't a good use of my time. I could learn more by reading and doing my own self-study. And I told this to my director of studies, and he just, you know, kind of lambasted me for like an hour about it. And I'm just like, this is stupid. And yet in reality, if you're able to say no, I mean, you guys are the psychological experts rather than me, but all of my reading has taught me that the ability to say no is one of the most healthy things you can learn relationally. So it's like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I could just share, Matt, you say something, but I've just got a little story that I'll tell. But you first, Matt.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I was just making the connection that, you know, the compliance sort of is directly correlated with the achievement aspect, right? So we need to all be compliant to be learning the curriculum, which can often be very narrow, to achieve that outcome of doing well on the final exam. And so it's very myopic, it's very narrow. And if you don't have compliance, that system doesn't work then, does it?
Well, because it's anti-human fundamentally.
It's anti-humanistic, but it's enormously beneficial socialistically. And in fact, the argument is that school system was developed to train people to go into factories and
that's right,
and behave. But just quickly, my story sort of related to what you're saying about compliance and also about the ability to say no. I had two excellent supports for the ability to say no. One was an incredibly supportive mother. A single mother looking after me. And so I had very secure attachment. And the other one was I was quite bright, but she always encouraged me to do various, whatever I was driven to do in various things. And it was in year 11, or sort of just in high school, just 2 years before graduation, I was having a very good time, one might say. And I think actually quite rightly, a few teachers got somewhat annoyed with me. So, we did have, I had a bit of an altercation with the maths master who was taking my higher maths class. I was doing lower maths and higher maths. You know. He said, you must not sit near that fellow, your friend John, because you're always disruptive and so on and so forth. So I thought, oh, fair enough. And I stopped doing that and I was doing okay. Anyway, we're now in the last year, when year 12 or sixth form, as we called it then. And he walked in the room, spoke a couple of sentences, looked at me and said, well, when you're ready, Mr. Hill, we will continue class. Come up to the staff room and get me. So he went off and my little brain said, well, my mother's not going to yell at me about this. So I said to my friends, does anybody need anything at the moment? Can you go on with some work? And they said, oh, yeah, we've got work we can go on with. So I didn't go up and get him. Then 30 minutes later, the lessons were 45 minutes long, he appears back with a piece of paper that was typed in three colours, which I imagine was quite an effort, excusing me from his class and permitting any other maths teacher to take me on. So there I was suddenly in my final year of school, just after the early March exams, then the main sort of test exams coming up in a few months' time. No maths teacher for my higher maths. I had one teacher who gave me a bit of a hand, and I did exactly what you were talking about. I found out that I could teach me. I could use the knowledge, I could use the frameworks, the textbooks, a little bit of assistance from even some of my other students. Anyway, I went along, but I said, I do say that I'm reasonably bright. And I went in, I did the thing, and I ended up came second in class. He then permitted me back, long story of the having to go through all kinds of the headmaster and things to try and force it to happen. And I was sitting there when he came over, and this is a really interesting interplay that you're talking about the compliance thing, because he came over and he said, well, Mr. Hill, which was the greatest insult in an Australian school, to call you Mr. Hill, what are you doing? And I was doing different work. He said, well, what was your mark in the exam? And I think I was 71 and the highest mark was 72. And it was a fascinating moment because, of course, he was befuddled. And he just sort of went, well, you could have done much better. And off he went. But it was a really interesting thing because it taught me that you can learn. You can learn by yourself. You don't need the strictures. You need the structures, but not the strictures of the system. Is that a good example of what you're hoping to teach people without having to go through that incredibly difficult, struggle that I went through for 3 or 4 months?
Yes and no. In the sense of self-directed learning, yes. In the sense of the type of material, not so much. So just to kind of return to Matthew's question about Universal OWL, we cover four main areas, and maths isn't one of them. So that's kind of the distinction between what we're doing and what you just said. So the four areas are psychology, philosophy, health, and finances. And we try to fit, you know, all of the major things one needs in order to lead a functional life fundamentally, because I think a lot of universal life is about being functional, into those four categories. So it's not entirely the same, but the spirit of self-directed learning, absolutely.
Yes, because I was really just describing the concept, understanding the concept, because, of course, that maths is quite useful in finances, I suppose. But yes, I had to bash my head against the, you know, I had to, you know, with a big stick to understand that that I was able to go. And then you're able to go off and learn anything. So the as I'm hearing there in the Universal Owl, it then opens up straight away through the philosophy and the psychology aspects of it. It opens up their minds to these frameworks to start with.
Can I just throw something in there just about maths? Because I've got two boys who just tune out. One, you know, is out of school, but when he was in school, you know, totally tuned out of maths. Maths was just had no connection with reality. And yet, both of them are very skillful in doing visual effects, working in game engines, you know, in doing modeling, rigging models in game engines. And there's a lot of maths involved in that sort of thing. And so they had a great intrinsic motivation to work mathematically in an environment that they were keenly interested in. And if there was, and it would frustrate me, I mean, if there was some way that they could learn their maths through something that was intrinsically motivating for them.
And the Universal Owl is really setting them up to seek that out. Is that that's part of your goal? Or to seek out that
to seek out their intrinsic, or
respond to their intrinsic motivation, perhaps, is even another thing. What do you think?
So currently not so much, no. Universal Owl is more currently teaching like objectively valuable knowledge. So people can use this in whichever way they choose, but like what they're actually being taught and how they're learning. Just because we're doing so via means of online courses, currently that's served to the students. We do hope that as we become larger and better known, we can get people more in touch with their intrinsic motivation. As a kind of slight aside, just on the subject of intrinsic motivation, are you guys familiar with unschooling?
Oh, yes, no. Somewhat.
You're a little bit? Yeah, no, please, I'd like to hear.
So my understanding of unschooling, Matthew, you can tell me if your understanding is different at all. So it's somewhat like homeschooling in the sense that the child is removed from a formal academic educational setting, i.e. a school building. But it's different in the sense that, at least in theory, you try as a parent to be led by the intrinsic interests and intrinsic motivations of the child. So unschooling experts talk about being the facilitator when you're the parent of an unschooled child. So, for example, say you have a five-year-old and you're like most five-year-old boys, he's obsessed with dinosaurs and rockets and space and other such things like that. It would then be your job as the parent to provide him with interesting documentaries or interesting books or maybe some toy dinosaurs that he can play with and then learning through play. And the idea is that you kind of follow that sense of intrinsic interest all the way through to adulthood, which is really interesting. And the reason why I'm thinking this in the context of maths, to come back to Richard's example, is I've read stories of parents who are concerned that their unschooled children weren't learning about things like maths and spelling and stuff. There was one case I read about where a child didn't even learn to read properly until they were about eight or something, which is quite unusual. Nevertheless, as the children got older, they actually started to overtake their peers because their motivation to improve in the specific areas in which they were interested was larger and larger. So I think that, I mean, if you take the argument that Universal Owl's ultimate goal is to create an entirely new type of educational system, I think that educational systems in general have to be much, much more focused on intrinsic motivation than they are at the moment. The million-dollar question then becomes, how do you do that at scale? Because it requires, a very dedicated parent, to say the least, to do that for an unschooled child. I don't even know whether I could do that for my own child and run a few businesses at the same time. But it's an interesting question philosophically to ponder.
And that is the problem, the scale problem, because At scale, yes. I mean, teachers already in packed classrooms can hardly cope with doing a set curriculum. So how would they possibly, you know, track every individual and their intrinsic motivations?
This takes my mind back to something that I've been fascinated with for about a decade or so, but the Peckham experiment that occurred in England, in Peckham, mm-hmm. in the 30s and 40s, finally finishing up in the 40s, which was very much framed around this open product of education. And so the idea of it was to see if communities could operate healthily or more healthily in an open, self-organizing system. And unfortunately, it closed down because it was a health-based thing. So it was with the health department. And when antibiotics became very successful, they closed it down because they said, we no longer need to have health. We can now just cure illness, which was that terrible shift that occurred. But they would make... they would have available all the things that that they would need, and then the children could just go down there and do whatever they liked, and they could seek out whoever they liked in order to advance themselves. And that this figure around eight or nine is exactly the figure the number that they came up with. That kids that came in sort of went backwards, but by the time they became 8 or 9. What they found was that the thing that they were interested in required a bit more English or a bit more economics or a bit more stuff, the subject that they didn't like, and they would seek out someone to help them do it as a natural course of events, because actually we've differentiated all these bits of knowledge, but we need kind of all these knowledges, maths, science, arts, philosophy, finances, in order to have a rounded life.
Yeah, I mean, you could make an analogy with the skills you need to run a business as an adult. I would say that most people starting a business, they come with what's sometimes referred to as the technical skill. If you look at it, I don't know whether you guys have read the book, The E-Myth, but he talks about technicians. It's a very, very good book.
Yeah,
Michael Gerber, I think his name is, the author. So for people who aren't familiar with Michael Gerber, like if you're a technician in the sense that he means in the book, it could mean, for example, say you've been an employee in marketing for 5 years, and then you have a kind of well-rounded sense of online marketing, and then you decide that you want to take that skill and you become an agency owner. The problem is that to be an agency owner, you need much more than just the marketing. So to return to the previous analogy, you have to then teach yourself the knowledge that you need to fill the gaps. So that could be accounting. It could be how to acquire customers. It could be how to set up processes and manage people. These are very core business skills. And so as an adult, if you want to become successful and be rounded, to use your word, you have to be willing to educate and perhaps even re-educate yourself in some of these areas. I know, just speaking for myself, that this is a process that never ends and probably never will end. I still feel incredibly ignorant in many areas of business, even though I'm doing reasonably well for myself. If adults learn like that, how much better would the world be if we already started teaching children to learn like that, as opposed to just be like, well, appeal to authority. You know, this authority says that the world is so-and-so, therefore I have to believe exactly what they say and just obey them and just follow their orders and regurgitate what they tell me to. And then what's the society do we end up with when we do that at scale? I don't think the prognosis is a very good one if that model continues.
Yeah. And there would be many listeners who are therapists who would resonate with what you're saying, because I very much doubt in high school nor in college or university where they studied psychology or counseling, would they have got any classes on how to run a business, and yet many of them run a private practice.
Yeah,
and not easy. Suddenly you're in the deep end, yeah.
But this whole process of being able to take a grip of the world that you need when you need it, and I say my mathematics story because I don't think I would be where I am now if that wretched, horrible teacher hadn't chucked me out of the maths class and shown me that I can do it myself because it was reframing. But your story is so much of that, constantly reassessing and reframing and rediscovering which is really play is enormously beneficial in that. I'm absolutely with you on that one.
I actually attribute quite a bit of my sort of business philosophy in general to playing strategy games like chess. I was kind of a bit of a chess prodigy as a kid. I entered tournaments and stuff and played at a national level when I was about 12 and then stopped and picked up the game about 10 years later again as an adult and was rather frustrated to find that in the time I'd stopped playing, everybody else had called me up and I was quite bad. chess, it teaches you strategic thinking, and it also teaches you that sometimes the most persistent player wins. I play a lot of blitz chess even today, and it frustrates me no end when I have objectively a winning position and then my opponent will just persist and persist and persist and persist. And sometimes, it's not always, but sometimes they'll beat me just by sticking through it and just by being creative. There's this concept in chess called counterplay, which is actually interesting in the context of our discussion talking about play. It's hard to explain counterplay, but basically you try to give yourself as many chances as possible to come back into the game and to complicate things and to make things difficult for your opponent. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what you guys think of that analogy, but I can certainly say that thinking strategically and about games in particular has definitely enriched my journey.
Well, certainly, I'm thinking, you know, persistence. I just was watching the thing about Thomas Edison. His persistence was what gave us the light globe. And there may have been many who tried before, and the only reason they failed is because they gave up. And I remember, you know, you would have these things of, I can guarantee you success, and of course that's rubbish. So someone started this one saying, I can't guarantee you success, but if you give up, I can guarantee you failure, which was quite a nice little homily, you know.
So strategic thinking and people or social skills combined, from my observation, seems to be critical ingredients for some of the most successful people on the planet. And one of the things I wanted to bring up, and it's not rote learning, which seems to be a bit of, you know, bread and butter of our current education system. Mm-hmm. And where that is problematic now and moving forward is with the advent of artificial intelligence and machine learning. And, you know, we're entering a world where we don't need to be so focused on rote learning, accumulating a huge database in our brain, because a lot of those things are either at your fingertips, or artificial intelligence, machine learning is going to be doing that for us. What are your thoughts about that?
That's a very interesting side question. I would say the first thing I would say is that I think it's less anxiety inducing than most people think it is. The world has gone through numerous types of industrial revolution previously. And I think there's this tendency to think that a lot of people won't quite know what to do with themselves. And whilst that may be true in the short term, I think that history shows us that humans are incredibly adaptable creatures and that somehow we'll figure out exactly what the future of work looks like. So I think that would be the first thing I would say. I would agree with the thrust of what you said, though, Matthew, in the sense that we don't need to be as obsessed with rote learning and just the blind doing of mechanical, repetitive tasks if those can be outsourced to machines. And I think that's another argument against the present education system in its current form. So when I was 18, I did a paper on Bismarck and Bismarck's Germany. And actually, one of the most interesting parts of that for my work these days was looking at the origins of the Western education system. And it wasn't just created to make factory workers, as is often thought, but it was also created to make obedient soldiers. There's an anecdote about Bismarck getting angry that some of his soldiers were doing the incredibly unreasonable thing of running away from a battle where there was no chance of them surviving. I mean, who would imagine why people would do that? And so he was like, the soldiers need to be more obedient, you know, very German. He's like, authority. And so how do we do this? And so the modern education system actually originated in Prussia in the 1870s and 1880s. And then that model was exported to America in the early 20th century and taken up by the General Education Board, I think it was called, or the GED, something along those lines. I forget the exact terminology. And then kind of propagated through the rest of the world. So obedience is literally where where this idea of education comes from. And to come back to Matthew's point, economically and technologically, we're going to reach a limiting point. And I think that started to happen. I mean, discussions about the education system being broken and being a gross waste of money, especially in America, where the cost of a college degree is frequently six figures. I think those conversations have become mainstream. And one of the reasons why I started Universal Hours, because I don't really see that many other people trying to form some kind of universal solution to this. I see politicians try to do that, and politicians tend to just make everything worse. But let's not get into that. We try and avoid politics as much as possible as Universal Hour. I think that's one of the things we say on the mission statement, in fact, as well, that we think that politics tends to just make everything worse. Therefore, we believe in non-political solutions to societal problems. Yeah.
So just circling back, the mechanization of pretty much every sort of job you can think of, and the question, what are we going to do? What's the future of work? And the common themes that always come out is what we're going to need is creativity, people skills, and exactly what you're saying about being able to strategize and strategize in a creative way. Machines are not great at doing any of those things, nor really would we want to give up our capacity to be creative and have a creative imprint on the world to a machine. Mm. So these skills, some would call them maybe soft skills, are absolutely vitally important.
Mm. Yes, I mean, another little, this is my school anecdote, but later on, doing my master's in brain and mind sciences, and we had formal exams, which I found fascinating. I had to, I'm now nearly, in my 50s, and I've got to get a number and sit at an appropriate desk and sign a piece of paper and do things. And I thought that was terribly amusing, which was rather arrogant of me. But we were quite doing a section of very technical work around the behavior of neurons and so on and so forth. And we came to a question, and fundamentally the question was basically, it's just fill in all the names of all the parts of this process. And I thought, oh my God, I could Google that. Mm. I mean, the question should be, on the basis of what this process is, what sort of therapy, what sort of therapeutic approach, or what sort of therapeutic understanding or client understanding do you need to get? And of course, I wanted that question because nobody else in the class would answer that, because they were all, sort of that very robotic and brilliant. I mean, they scared the hell out of me because they knew everything, but they didn't know how to treat anybody. Which was the
creative part is the key.
Yeah, it was interesting.
We could even broaden the conversation about allopathic medicine in general. Yes. This idea in Western medicine where we're just obsessed with diagnosing people and giving them whatever drugs they need at the particular time. It'd be much more interesting to look at the person holistically and then try to figure out why, where do the symptoms come from? And we always like this principle of seven whys, like always asking more and more whys until you get to the ultimate cause is interesting. I wanted to respond to something that Matthew said earlier, which is interesting about creative thinking. I presume you guys have read The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem by Nathaniel Brandon. Yeah. So there's this idea in that book, which I think is really, really awesome, about competence. And self-efficacy, and that being just a huge thing that's correlated with self-esteem in general. Actually, one of my writers for Universal Hour is a former PhD psychologist, and she hates the idea of self-esteem. She thinks it's a useless concept. But so one of the key insights, I think, from that book, which helped me, was that self-esteem is correlated with self-efficacy and knowing that you are good at things. And I think that's an interesting insight if you're an intelligent person who's stuck in academia, which I think constitutes a certain percentage of the population, especially in their teens and early 20s when you're stuck in academia. And then you come into, just from my own journey, you come into the regular world and you're just like, why does nothing I learn work? And it's unbelievably depressing. And so then you see the sort of negative side of what I'm talking about, that if you lack competence, your self-esteem goes into the gutter. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that raw IQ is not sufficient. You actually have to have real life competency in all of its different forms. And then to come back to what we were saying about unschooling, if you don't have a competency in a certain area, your life experience will show you that that's the case. And then you have to go and playfully engage with that area of life, and you'll probably fail a few times, but if you see failure as part of the journey and nothing to be ashamed of, which was a huge realization for me, then eventually you'll figure it out.
And yeah. and that's the key to it. We need to repair self-esteem, and we need to return self-esteem. But that only assumes that self-esteem can be broken, and that self-esteem can require repair. And of course, if your esteem is based in yourself, then that's okay. But if your self is based in external standards and values and systems, then of course you're in great deal of trouble. One of the way the words I find has been ruined by this externalized world is the word responsibility. Whereas nobody wants to be responsible, because responsible means who's at fault, who's guilty, who's wrong. And that person inevitably will have to pay some kind of price in order to repair the situation. But the word really comes from responsible. And are you responsible? Oh, well, I failed at this. Well, clearly you need to learn some more responses, because you were not responsible enough. And
it's more so about ownership than blame, yes, in other words.
Yeah, you weren't self-efficacious enough. But it's pulling in these ideas, and it's not so much what we need to fix. It's realizing that if we need to fix something, then something's broken. And this is what I think you've done. And people sort of say, how do we fix education? You say, you must first acknowledge that it's broken.
It's so obvious. I mean, it's how much more empirical evidence do we need as a society before we're able to acknowledge that it's broken? I mean, it's kind of a controversial way to start our mission page, but it's just so obviously true. And your truth is my highest value, as I'll tell my girlfriend and my friends frequently. Like integrity as well. I mean, that's another thing that Nathaniel Brandon talks about a lot in this book. To go back to what you were saying, Richard, about extrinsic versus intrinsic, like if you're constantly living for extrinsic validation, your self-esteem is going to be very, very fragile. So another personal anecdote of mine, I used to have a very big marketing client. He's paying about six figures a year. It was a huge contract for me at the time. But the guy was a huge jerk. So we kind of rode off the back of this contract for a couple of years. And we put up with all of his nonsense. And eventually I got to the point where I just fired the client. And, you know, 2015 Jeff would have just been shocked that I had the temerity to do anything like that. Because it's just like, why on earth do you fire someone who's giving you that much money? It doesn't make any sense. The problem is that I realized that I was attaching my satisfaction and self-esteem actually fundamentally to the fact that this guy was paying us so much money. And in so doing was just hemorrhaging myself in so many different ways, because we were just exposing ourselves. There's always a cost, right, in life. Like, I think that's another thing that people need to understand. And the cost of this guy's money was putting up with all of his objectively toxic behavior. And so when I learned that, I was then able to distance myself from it and say, actually, my sense of security and my sense of integrity as an individual is something I can always control internally. Like, there are internal metrics to that. And that was one of the most freeing decisions I ever made in my life. The client was completely baffled. He was like, Jeff, I've paid you, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I'm just like, yep, I don't care. Bye.
Yes. Yeah.
Another yes. thing too that yeah. we haven't, it might be getting a bit late now to touch on some of these things, but you know, Richard and I we talk a lot about physiology when it comes to psychology. Yeah. And there are only a certain percentage of kids that can sit still in a classroom learning academic stuff. And this is a very artificial way to spend childhood. Yeah. And it's not a very not efficient and shaming, because they're continually getting into trouble because they're bored, or they just can't sit still, or it's just there's no, like we were saying, there's no intrinsic motivation to pay attention.
Yeah. Again, it's anti-human nature from my perspective, because, I mean, especially a young boy is not going to want to sit in the classroom. He's just going to want to go and play outside with sticks and naturally run into his limitations. I think there's a lot of psychology that I've read, notably some of the work of Jordan Peterson. I'm sure you guys are familiar with him. He talks a lot about the impact of education on young boys. I have a question for you guys, because you've got more of a psychological background than me, and I love talking to people who are more educated than me. It's always a great joy. So I have this theory about codependence, and I'm thinking that if codependence is ultimately the struggle to say no, and this kind of sense of enmeshment in unhealthy relationships, to what extent do you think that sort of codependent thread within society is actually created and nourished by the school system, where, as we were saying before, it's incredibly difficult to say no. There are lots of toxic behaviours, like in some of the, you know, the examples Richard was using from his childhood, the teachers like, Mr. Hill, you must do this. The sense of shaming and judging and criticism, which as an intelligent therapist, you just be like, this person is just objectively toxic, this behavior is toxic, you have to stay away from this. So your thoughts on that, I'd be curious to hear.
I'd actually like to change the word. I don't think it's a codependence. I think it's a dependence. Okay. What you do is that the system we have removes your individual contribution to being an individual. Your contribution becomes something that needs to be manipulated and malleable to such degree. So you need to shift yourself to satisfy the system. And so therefore, what you're constantly doing, and I get what you mean by codependence, but what I'm constantly doing as I go through the education system to satisfy them is to figure out what answers they need. See, I came out from my brain and mind science degree and I actually castigated the examiner. I said, what a stupid question you asked. You know, it was blah, blah, blah. Now, of course, I'm sure that he then had a lower opinion of me. And if I wanted to continue in academia, I might come across him sometime when I'm getting a job and he would say, oh, you're the guy who criticized me. You're not getting the job. So there's all this, what do we call doffing the cap, you know, sort of making
it's
yourself...
It's people-pleasing behavior fundamentally.
Not only, yes, it's not only compliance, but it's supplicance. For many people who are, the more distant you are from the mean, the more supplicating you have to be, which tends to then result in more radicalism and more revolutionism and more disruption.
Mm. And you said it is fundamentally people-pleasing. Well, it's people-pleasing with a very fundamental purpose of attachment, you know, this extension of the family really as, young kids being in this environment of the school and they're still developing, you know, their sense of attachment. And this is a very important extension of the family. And so we do want to comply to a certain degree because we don't want to be rejected. We want to have that sense of attachment because that is fundamentally safe for us. It's a survival on the very base level. It's a survival issue. Yes. If we're not accepted by the tribe, what happens? We don't want to be kicked out because you will die.
Yeah, most of us remember teachers where we had a secure attachment and we remember badly those teachers where we were insecurely attached because where we had to go every day to learn, but they would... I remember our year in primary school, the last year, he just would cane us with the feather duster, you know, with the bamboo part, because he said, that's what's going to happen in high school, so I'm getting you ready for it. Do come to school tomorrow. Really? You might hit me tomorrow. You know? So we were actually afraid to go to school in that last year. Or, as I say, for those who were a bit more defiant, they would go there and they'd literally do things to get this punishment to say, see, I'm, finger up to you. But it was cutting your nose off to spite your face. And a couple of those lovely fellas, as lovely as they were, did end up in jail, which is a, great shame. And I believe that it was the teacher that did this to them or made this the sort of quality that came out in them.
Matthew, I wanted to respond to what you said about this almost like a sense, this sense of anxious attachment being adaptive. I think that when you're a child, you have to be, it is evolutionarily essential that you're accepted, but you feel to a degree accepted by your family. Because if you were to be abandoned, say at the age of 6 by your parents, you just objectively would not survive. And that's as true as in the modern world as it is in the prehistorical world. One of the things I've learned in my reading and life experience is that there's this tension between going along with the tribe in order to be accepted and authenticity and being yourself. And humans have both needs. We want to both be accepted by the tribe and we also want to be ourselves and live in line with integrity. I guess the point is that the older you get, as people go through the process of maturation and individuation, the stronger that need for authenticity becomes. And at a certain point, and perhaps this is the moment of individuation, kind of at the end of childhood psychologically, I would say you have to be willing to break bonds that don't serve you anymore, however those look relationally. You have to be willing to say, actually, as I did with this particular client, for example, I don't need you in order to survive. And this is what I mean by codependence. I do actually think the prefix co is important, because a certain type of dependence is always going to be healthy. I mean, if I go to the supermarket, for example, it's valuable to me that they provide me all the food. I wouldn't want to do that for myself. It would be unbelievably arduous to do. It's also valuable for them that I give them money. So it's the basis of trade, is interdependence. Codependence, I understand it, and I haven't heard other people like talk about it like in this sense. It's a sense of forced dependence, that I must, to use Richard's word, supplicate myself. I thought it was a very good choice of word, in order to gain the approval of some kind of external force. And that is just dysfunctional. And I think the less we have of that in society, the better. And I'm hoping that Universal Owl philosophically can strengthen people at their core, so that they can get to the point where they feel, again, to go back to the mission page, so they feel as self-sufficient and competent as possible, and they can say yes or no to any type of relationship with just about anybody and say, okay, if this comes with consequences, I can live with the consequences. That's totally fine. I think the ability to be able to say no and to hear no is one of the most healthy things you can teach anybody. But it's a journey, right? Like, people are born and they are incredibly codependent. Like when you're an infant, you're so dependent on your family and you couldn't survive without them. And then the older you get, I love the idea of age appropriateness in psychology. It's one of my favorite concepts. Like the idea of age appropriate behavior in child psychology is super, super interesting. I've got a friend who's a pediatric nurse in the UK, and we talk about this quite frequently. So then the art as the parent is to understand what age appropriate behavior is, and then to sort of gradually withdraw your control of your child's life in particular areas as they push back against you. And I think that that analogy is interesting from the perspective of the education system. I think the degree to which we're infantilized in the education system is absolutely astounding. Mm. I think, Matthew, you may have even used that in your email to me, that exact term, infantilization.
And again, the system really isn't set up for self-sufficiency, is it? I mean, how would you manage 30 kids in a classroom all wanting to be their own individual selves? That won't work.
Right. Yeah. I'm reminded of, I know a guy in Germany who is around my kind of age, so early 30s. He's still in formal education, but unlike Richard, for example, who had a career as an actor and then decides to go and retrain, which is a very different matter.
Yes.
He's never provided for himself financially. He's got, in German, it's called BAföG, which is like, it's kind of like a sort of financial assistance from students. He's lived off that and like student dead-end jobs. And from my perspective, he's not started his life as an adult. He's not learned to look after himself. He's not gone into the working world and had to deal with negotiation and conflict, which is, you know, so unbelievably important to be able to deal with these things. It's also skills that we're trying to teach at Universal Owl, by the way, negotiation and conflict, because I think they're important. And I think that my friend, he's been infantilized and just doesn't know it. And it's tragic. You're someone who is a believer in human potential. I look at that and I think it's tragic. I think it's really sad. I would love to see him, you go out and, it sounds strange, but like to go out and fail and actually to learn from those failures and to just see that as just life experience and play. I think that he would really benefit from that.
Mm. Mm. You've got one course up on Universal Owl, the first and only course that you've got available at the moment.
That's right. We were thinking a lot about what the first course was that we wanted to release, and we decided that because of my background in marketing and writing and languages, and my partner, he's been a writer and a communicator, and actually also has a background in acting, funnily enough, so that's yet another commonality that we have. He's been doing those things for about 20 years. So we figured that communication would be the place to start. And then the question is, well, what aspect of communication do you want to talk about? Because it's obviously a huge, huge subject. And we figured we would go straight to the fundamentals immediately, because that's what's helped me the most with my personal journey. And I know also from the perspective of John, my business partner, that these have helped him a lot. So the purpose of the course is to teach the difference between assertive communication, aggressive communication, and passive aggressive communication. And it's very much an overview. So the course is I mean, depending on your speed, most people do it between an hour and 2 hours, I would say, on average. And it's replete with practical examples and quizzes and handouts that will teach you in an interactive sort of way how to recognize these types of communication pattern in yourself and in the people around you. And the hope is that by raising people's consciousness in this area, they can have more functional relationships across their, you know, across all dimensions of life. And the target audience is young people. So we want to talk to people between 16 to 25, and we want to kind of intervene early to use therapeutic language and get them to take this knowledge throughout their lives. That's the plan.
It's absolutely fundamental. And it is something that we're infantilized with communications. I mean, that was the great thing about the being in acting school. In fact, I did a workshop recently called Almost Everything I Know in Psychotherapy I Learned in Acting School.
Nice.
Because it's true, that sense of what other people are like and discovering the other person in yourself and various aspects. But we're not taught that. And in fact, it was something we were talking about a movie the other day, a thing called Brain on Fire, which is about the NMDA encephalitis. But one of the things I was saying to Matt was what amazed me was the excellent depiction of how infantile or how young or how unsophisticated is the average person's ability to be aware of somebody else's health and well-being. And they just all missed it. They just completely missed really, really obvious stuff. And I think this is this very, very much so in the nature of communication. You know, you do Shakespeare for a while, and as annoying as it is in some of the old English, you start to, when you understand the ways in which these people communicate and the variations, it can be wonderful. But of course, you don't have to do Shakespeare. But it is an extraordinary thing to explore these fundamental natures of when someone says that, what do you think they're on about? I mean, it's quite extraordinary how people will have very limited and simplistic sort of view. So what a wonderful place to start. It is the most fundamental place to start. I congratulate you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And to just echo your comments,
absolutely.
Should be one of the last things we say, because I know we've already been talking a while. It's late in Australia. I think that people's lack of understanding in this area, a lot of it stems from ego. What I mean by that in this case is that I think for people who are therapeutically minded, it's, if you're a good therapist anyway, it's easy to understand people because you've gone so deep into yourself. You've explored your own shadow. You have looked at your own weaknesses in great detail. You've analyzed them. You look at your own strengths as well in great detail, of course, but the ego is more of a block to looking at weaknesses, I would say. And I think the more work you've done like that internally, the easier it is to identify to what degree someone else is psychologically healthy or not. So to come back to Universal Owl and the communication course, our hope is that first and foremost, and this is actually a very Universal Owl point in general, was we're all about improving the individual. So I think the first step is to recognize that your own communication style perhaps has some things you can work on. Once you've identified, people tend to, in my experience, they tend to trend either passive-aggressive or aggressive if they have dysfunctional communication. So notice which of those two you lean to. Do your best to make yourself more assertive, whichever conclusion you come to. And once you've gone through that journey, which, I mean, for me, I was definitely more of the passive-aggressive type, and it took me probably 3 years to figure out a lot of that kind of stuff. This is quite a long time ago now. But having done all of that work, it means that you're able to then see what is healthy and observe in other people when they are healthier or less healthy accordingly. And the ability to be able to perceive that sort of psychological health of an individual is so unbelievably useful, in my opinion, because it means you will extricate yourself from toxic situations and toxic people so quickly. An example comes to mind. I do some content marketing consulting for another company on the side just at the moment. And there was a new hire that was made about 2 months ago. And I told my manager on the first day I spoke to her that this person was dysfunctional. Literally the first day, I actually had it because my manager's also a good friend of mine. She said to me, this person is like very argumentative. And instantly I was just like, being argumentative is not necessarily a good thing. Being assertive is a very good thing, but being argumentative is very different. And I thought to myself, this person probably has a very large ego. And it was indeed exactly the case that they had a very large ego. And it was incredibly obvious day one that they were dominating conversations and talking over people and reaching into areas where they didn't actually have any purview. And I pointed this out on like day two or three of the person's tenure. And now 2 months later, blessedly, she's decided that ironically, the organization is dysfunctional and not she is dysfunctional, which is very telling. But like,
lucky them.
I'm able to look at these sorts of things because I've done all of this work on myself, which of course never ends because everyone's a work in progress. I guess in summary, Universal Hour is about getting people to realize truths about themselves and objective truths about human nature, perhaps even more fundamentally, and then apply those truths to reality and other people and society. And I would close on a very uplifting note, which is we don't know what the limitations of that are. Like if everybody were to go inside themselves and work on themselves and become the best person they could be and were equipped with the tools and the skills and the knowledge and the wisdom to do this from such a young age, we don't know where the limitations are if we do that societally. We don't even know what the limitations are on that individually. I think that one of the things I've learned in my journey is that humans are much, much more courageous and resilient than most of us give ourselves credit for. I imagine you guys have probably noticed that as well in psychotherapy. So that's a thought that sustains me when, you know, as it is inevitable with businesses, there are hard days and you look at cash flow and you think, God, how the hell am I going to make it? But that's something that sustains me.
What the unlimitations are going to be.
You could put it that way.
Jeff, this is a brilliant project. I'm just so glad that you reached out to connect so that we can find out about this.
Awesome. All right. This has been really, really enjoyable. I'm going to take this positive energy for the rest of my day now.
We'll take it to sleep. Fabulous conversation. I'm not sure we're going to be able to fit all that in one episode, but let's see what we can do. And I'm keen to talk to him again. Absolutely. So we've obviously got, he's just started that one course starting with communication. So as he brings more things online, you know, I want to check in with him and see what he's doing. Very interesting chap.
Very, very interesting. Yes. So please do check out universalowl.com and have a look at what Jeff is doing there. And we're gonna keep in contact with Jeff and we'll track him in his endeavor.
And of course, don't forget that we are sponsored by the wonderful BetterHelp program that may very much interest you as a way to supplement and add or even be a main part of your income. But the beauty is that they are supporting us and you can get a full year's subscription for free as part of the engagement if you choose to do it with them. So check them out. They're really honest and straightforward people. It's great.
Yeah, fantastic. So check out betterhelp.com. Link will be in the show notes. And just a reminder, that is for our American therapists at the moment. So only American therapists. Well, Richard, it's been a pleasure as always.
Yes, indeed. And so that's it for this week. And we will have something exciting again next week, I'm sure.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning into the Science of Psychotherapy podcast, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.